What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
It's a strange shift, isn't it? The parent who raised you needs some help, and you want to be there. With Care.com, you don't have to do it alone. Whether you're clear on the kind of care your aging loved one needs or still figuring it out, we've got support. Find background-checked in-home senior caregivers for anything from companionship to dementia care, or browse senior living communities, read reviews, even schedule a tour, plus access to safety checks to help with your peace of mind. Still not sure what's best? Our senior care advisors, who are all master's level social workers, can help you build a plan. For a limited time, use the code LISTEN20 for 20% off your initial care.com subscription. That's LISTEN20, all one word, good for 20% off. Start your senior care journey with confidence.
Hello and welcome to the Katie Halper Show. You can find the Katie Halper Show on iTunes, where you can rate and review us. You can also find us on SoundCloud, find us on Facebook. Become Patreon supporters at patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow, where you'll get access to extended interviews and extra episodes. Save the date and buy your tickets, May 10th at Littlefield. The Katie Halper Show will be doing a live show with our friends, the Struggle Session podcast. That's Leslie Lee and Jack Allison. So these two great shows will be coming together for one night only, for now. One night only live taping of the Katie Halper Show and Struggle Session with amazing special guests, including Rolling Stones' Matt Taibbi, Jamie Peck, the co-host of the podcast The Antifada, also a journalist in her own right, and stand-up comedian Jake Flores, who's also the co-host of the podcast Pod Damn America. That's Friday, May 10th at Littlefield in Brooklyn. On this show, you'll be hearing from four different people. First, you'll hear from two people, a former editor and writer from the Center for American Progress's Think Progress publication. They shared the experiences of working there under Neera Tanden and talk, of course, about the beef between Center for American Progress and Bernie Sanders. And the reason we're talking about that is because this past weekend, Bernie Sanders finally hit back, not physically, although Neera Tanden, we now know, thanks to a New York Times article, has actually hit her employers, or shoved them, as she says. Someone said that she punched one. She says that she shoved him. So he metaphorically hit back at Center for American Progress over a really bad video that they put out, which attacked him for being a millionaire while being a socialist. Sanders sent the organization a letter criticizing them for playing a quote-unquote destructive role in the critical mission to defeat Donald Trump. Tanden, in turn, admitted that the video was overly harsh, but she insisted that Think Progress is editorially independent of CAP. Also, her mother got in on the act and said in a New York Times interview, "Those Bernie brothers are attacking her all the time, but she lets them have it too." I actually literally thought for a second, I thought she meant Bernard and Larry Sanders, but she meant, of course, Bernie Bros. Then we talked to Rebecca Vilkomerson of Jewish Voice for Peace, a national organization working to bring progressive Jewish values to work for a just and lasting peace in the Middle East, basically. Make sure you check out the Patreon-only interview I did with Zed Jelani, where he talks about being yelled at by Neera Tanden for writing about a conflict of interest that Mayor Michael Bloomberg had. Zed also talks about how John Podesta pressured him against writing about Afghanistan in a critical way. And Zed also talks about the real difference in political policy and outlook between the Neera Tanden, Hillary Clinton, Obama wing of the Democratic Party and the Bernie wing of the Democratic Party. That's not really a wing, it's just Bernie. Bernie and other insurgent candidates. And again, to do that, just go to patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Okay, so I think we have our first set of guests on the line. Zed Jelani and Ben Amberster. Are you guys there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, Zed. Hey, Ben. How are you guys?
Good. How are you?
Good. So both of you are former employees of Think Progress. Ben, you're now at Win Without War. And Zed Jelani, a former Intercept journalist, you are now at Berkeley doing working on a cool project about what bipartisan relations?
Social and political polarization. So, it's about parties, but also beyond parties.
Great. Okay. Yeah, I made it sound like it was a dating website, so apologies for that. But can you guys explain to people, so that this isn't just kind of an inside baseball thing, what happened between this Center for American Progress, what they are, and why this whole kind of beef with Bernie is important?
I'll let you take that.
Okay,
one.
And I'll because you guys aren't here, I'll say Zed. Can you answer that? Then I'll say Ben. Yeah.
Okay. Sure. So it's interesting that I guess a good question actually is where do you want to start, because the timeline goes back
right.
quite a bit. So, where is it?
Well,
you'd
first,
like to
just to set
question.
It up, we're talking about a think tank called Center for American Progress, which is one of the biggest liberal think tanks in the United States. Right. It's very Clinton aligned. And they have a website called Think Progress, where both of you wrote and edited. Ben, you edited there, right? And Zed, you wrote there?
That's right.
And it's in the news because the head of the think tank is Neera Tanden, and she's a very extremely online person. And it's been in the news because Think Progress, which is the blog that they run, the website they run, wrote a hit piece against Bernie Sanders for being a millionaire. And then they made a video of Bernie Sanders saying millionaire, billionaire, implying that once he became a millionaire, he stopped going after millionaires and only went after billionaires. There's this very weird narrative that says that Bernie Sanders is a hypocrite because it turns out he made a lot of money off of his books. And the narrative is that because he wants people to pay more in taxes or their fair share in taxes, and he is technically a millionaire, he's a hypocrite. Of course, what would make him a hypocrite would be if he had said, everyone but me should pay more taxes. So he's not actually a hypocrite. Anyway, we can get into that later. But the point is they went after him, and Bernie, in a rare move, his campaign actually responded in a letter. And that's rare because Bernie does try to stay above the fray. But this time, I guess, why do you think it's so significant? And yes, Zed, wherever you're a journalist, so tell us where you would like to start the story.
Yeah, I mean, so Ben and I both worked at Think Progress, which was kind of the weblog hosted by the Center for American Progress. Center for American Progress is a very influential think tank. It's technically nonpartisan, but much more influential among Democrats than Republicans. They typically staff Democratic administrations. They certainly staff a big part of Obama's administration. And they have Think Progress is kind of part of CAP Action, or Center for American Progress Action, which is kind of their more political site, which does a lot of political communications. So I think when Sanders' team saw that video up, basically they saw that as this action-oriented part of the think tank coming out there and criticizing them. And there's this long background of the leadership of the Center for American Progress is more towards the Clinton wing of the Democratic Party. Neera Tanden, in particular, the head of the Center for American Progress, is very anti-Sanders on social media and on cable television as well. And so there was this long background, and actually the same day that Bernie Sanders released his healthcare plan, the Center for American Progress, including Neera Tanden, did a long off-the-record call with reporters attacking the plan, undermining it because they have their own plan that's competing. So they're largely viewed as a competing faction of the Democratic Party. While they were doing that, at the same time, Neera Tanden is very vocally making this message that Democrats shouldn't attack each other, they shouldn't compete with each other, they just lay off each other. She spent a lot of time last year saying that people shouldn't be writing articles critical of Beto O'Rourke. I wrote an article critical of Beto O'Rourke, doing some critical reporting on him.
Just to pause really quickly, listeners may remember that there was this whole narrative online and in actual real newspapers, real media, real magazines, real websites, saying that there was an attack spurred on by Sanders supporters against Beto O'Rourke. There was a huge conflagration of articles about that. And that was based on largely on Neera Tanden, the head of this think tank, tweeting negatively about a tweet from journalist David Sirota, just to give the context. So, yes. So things online go offline.
Yeah, so basically, I think the Sanders camp, they wrote a letter to the head of, to the board of CAP saying, hey, you guys talk a game about unity, but you're attacking us here. The board, initially, CAP kind of defended the video to some extent, but then one of the board members, Tom Steyer, who's actually a billionaire, a Democratic donor, came out and said, hey, I actually didn't like that video. So then Cap kind of backed off a little bit and apologized, which is really interesting because Cap has been making this argument for years that money doesn't influence them. And they're, again, you know, corporate donors or foreign government donors, they don't, none of those matter. But as soon as their billionaire board member says, I think we went a little too far, then they're like, oh, okay, you're right. He's right. Yes, of course we went too far. So I thought it was a little interesting natural experiment in terms of the influence of money on Cap. So.
So did they apologize, or what? How did they respond to Steyer?
I mean, they just basically said something like it was overly critical or harsh or something, that the video that they made, they kind of conceded that point publicly. But, you know, I think this is something that's going to be ongoing, simply because I think they are just a competing faction of people within kind of a political coalition. And I think that, you know, I don't think we're gonna see the Sanders Cap war end anytime soon.
And one of the big discussions right now, and Ben, I'd love to hear your thoughts about this, is the idea of whether or not this blog, this website, is independent of the think tank that it's run by. And so one of the responses from the think tank, from Center for American Progress, is that they have no editorial control over Think Progress, their website, their blog. So when there are these hit pieces against Sanders, and when there are these videos against Sanders, they have no control over it, right? It has nothing to do with Center for American Progress. But there's been some pushback on that by people who've actually worked there. So can you share your experiences there, Ben?
Yeah, so this is the other side of this story, is this editorial independence issue. And, you know, I'll get into the backstory on this, but I think up front, you kind of have to recognize that both sides, the Center for American Progress, and the Action Fund, as well as Think Progress, have an interest in, you know, presenting this persona as Think Progress as editorially independent. Because, like, when these things happen, and, you know, those that are being attacked on Think Progress go and in turn criticize Cap, you know, Cap can throw up their hands and say, oh, well, it's not us.
Right.
And sort of vice versa. But to step back a little bit on this issue, you know, one of the reasons why Think Progress is so invested in this editorial independence goes back a number of years to the time when Zed and I were there. And, you know, this is a whole long story, but back in 2011, 2012, we were viciously smeared and attacked for some of the things we were writing on Iran and Israel. And in response to that, you know, CAP, the think tank led by Neera Tanden and other senior staffers, were, you know, vigorously monitoring what we wrote and censoring the things that we wrote on Iran and Israel to placate those who were attacking us. And it was a very, you know, sort of serious and traumatic time for all of those involved. And since then, you know, because all of this stuff sort of leaked to the press, you know, Think Progress has been, you know, they started to, like, you know, work harder towards, you know, this perception of editorial independence. And to their credit, you know, after we left, you know, and Think Progress writers unionized, they sort of had it stipulated in their contract that, you know, there is editorial independence from Think Progress and CAP. Now, that's great. And I think that achievement has essentially, you know, built a little bit of a wall between Think Progress and Center for American Progress, at least the one that wasn't there before. So that's a good thing. The thing that I sort of, like, posit is that, you know, how far does this editorial independence go? Because, you know, yes, while Neera and CAP senior staffers probably aren't meddling in the day-to-day affairs of Think Progress, but, like, at the same time, you know, how vigorously are Think Progress reporters sort of looking into the inner workings of CAP? And, you know, I would argue that they aren't really much at all, because there's a lot of stuff to report about the corruption that's going on within CAP that I don't think Think Progress really touches so much. So that's an issue that I think that needs to be explored a little bit more.
They went after him about being a millionaire in a video and in a very embarrassingly written piece. And they allegedly do journalism. Both of you worked there. And tell us more about the relationship between Center for American Progress and its donors. And also, there was actually the New York Times has picked up this story, and they have a story where they tell about how, and this is interesting because the Fez Shakir, who is now the head of he's the campaign director of Bernie Sanders' campaign. He used to work for Think Progress too, right? He was, I think, the editor.
Yeah, he was the editor in chief.
The editor in chief. And there's a story in the New York Times about how he, at a campus Center for American Progress event, asked Hillary Clinton a question about her vote on the Iraq War. And at the end of said event, when it was done, apparently Neera Tanden circled around to the back of the room and punched him in the chest. Now, she says that she just shoved him or pushed him. She didn't punch him. But did you guys know about that at the time? Was that big water cooler chatter?
I had not heard about this until I read that story. You know, but I mean, you know, I think the way that Neera, I don't even think I was there at the time when that happened. So, but I think that Neera, you know, didn't really make a lot of friends with some of us, you know, given her response to the way that we were being smeared in the media for our reporting on Iran and Israel. And I just want to say one thing. I mean, I think you said that you know, Think Progress reporters are allegedly journalists. I just want to make clear, there are a lot of really smart, good reporters at Think Progress that do a lot of good work. So I just want to be upfront about that.
Yeah, and I'd want to emphasize that for the whole think tank. I think Ben and I both agree that, you know, everything we're saying about the think tank doesn't mean that there aren't people at the think tank who work very hard, who have very passionate beliefs, who really try to improve the world. And I think, in a sense, it's like a microcosm of the U.S. government. There's people, I know people who work in the administration right now who I think are making a sincere effort to do their jobs well. But there are corrupting influences in government, and the same thing kind of exists in think tanks, which are kind of a microcosm of governments.
Right. Yeah, and I should explain. When I was saying journalism, I was referring to that particular piece, which I thought was such a hit piece and such a smear.
Yeah, it's terrible.
That's what I meant. And in fact, what's funny is that, you know, I signed up like years ago by accident to like, no, I think on purpose, because I like Think Progress so much. This was like pre-Bernie, that I like Think Progress so much that I would actually automatically retweet them on Twitter. Like, I signed up for something to do that. Then I stopped doing it. Politics aside, I think it was just annoying. It was too much. But no, there is great journalism that comes out of it. And of course, like many websites or many people, you know, I'll look at their what they say or hear what they say. And, you know, it's like 70%. I'm like, yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then once it gets to the Sanders-Clinton divide, obviously Clinton's not running, but to the two wings of the Democratic Party, I'm like, what? Anyway.
Yeah, and it's not only that, and I'll sort of, you know, sort of contrast what I just said and what Zed just said, you know, giving them compliments. On the other side of that, you know, in that story that you just referenced about Neera punching Faz in the chest, there was another really interesting bit of information that was published for the first time, which is that since 2016 through the end of 2018, CAP accepted $2.5 million from the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, which of course is allied with Saudi Arabia, as a, you know, sort of ridiculously poor human rights record, you know, have been waging this, you know, awful war in Yemen for years and causing, you know, one of the largest humanitarian crises in the world. And, you know, so hearing that news kind of, you know, sort of explains why, you know, the Center for American Progress largely sat out of the fight to pass the War Powers Resolution on Yemen. So it's that kind of stuff that I think Zed and I are talking about. It's like, there are lots of great people who do lots of great work there. And I think that that's probably like 80% of what's going on. But then there's this sort of other smaller 20% that, like, you know, is like corrupt and just really distasteful.
Yeah. And what about, can you guys talk about their relationship with Israel or with Netanyahu? Because I know that there are people very upset about Neera Tanden hosting him.
I don't think that there is a direct foreign government relationship the way there was one with the UAE. I mean, I wrote several stories for The Intercept about, based off of emails from hacked emails from the UAE ambassador's inbox, that showed that, you know, senior staff at CAP were literally helping the UAE lobby the Trump administration. They were helping organize trips overseas to the UAE government to promote their policy agendas. I mean, they were deeply in bed with the UAE, and they were all being funded by the UAE. I don't think a similar thing exists with Israel. I view that more as a domestic politics thing. So, you know, Ben can also speak to this, but I think in the Democratic Party in particular, during a certain moment in the Obama administration, there was a very harsh kind of fight back and push back to hem in the Obama administration to make sure they didn't pressure Israel very much. Mm-hmm. And I think pressuring CAP was viewed as part of that campaign. And so there were folks influential in the Democratic Party who were very pro-Israel, for instance, Ann Lewis. At one point, I think Alan Dershowitz even like got mad internally at CAP, and they like hired a PR firm to talk to him and like talk him down and everything. But part of responding to all these influential people within the Democratic Party who are very pro-Israel was kind of tamping down on internal dissidence within CAP, because particularly when the period that we're talking about, which is like 2011, 2010, at that point, there was very little criticism of Israel from the Democratic Party. Like right now, what's happening right now with Bernie Sanders and even Beto O'Rourke saying some stuff, it's a very different political environment. And I think back then there was intense pressure to not really say too much on that. And a lot of that is coming from people within the Democratic Party who historically are influential and very pro-Israel, people who are close to Hillary Clinton, like Ann Lewis and Dershowitz, and also just, obviously AIPAC, ADL, all these organizations that have kind of tried to keep a taboo about this issue.
Right.
And they just, you know, they created a difficult environment at CAP. And I think Neera Tanden was, I think she was just very, you know, I think internally she probably just thought, hey, in politics, you just can't say that much about Israel. It'll cause a lot of trouble. So we need to be cognizant of that fact. You know, she treated it as more like a political operation than I think kind of a independent journalist or kind of a free-flowing think tank that can just work out the ideas about this when it came to that issue.
Right. And what were you guys there when she invited Netanyahu to speak at an event?
No, I was not.
Zed, were you?
No, I was gone by that point.
Oh, okay. That's too bad. You could have asked him you could have had your pictures taken with him. And had him sign.
That event was a good point, though, because if you read the Podesta emails and WikiLeaks, you'll see that Neera Tanden. Yeah,
so just to explain that. So Neera Tanden and the Center for American Progress, they were big part of their documents were part of the WikiLeaks dump. In fact, I think Neera Tanden described you as a freak, Zed. Is that what it was? Congratulations.
Well, you know,
I'll say that you don't have to.
People get angry, and
you're very fair about this stuff.
I don't hold it against her or whatever, but
it just happens to be funny. And in full disclosure, I feel like as a journalist, you know, as this very serious journalism show, which you're appearing on right now, we have to share that. But I cut you off. So you were saying that you reviewed these for
what was in some of the WikiLeaks emails is that you'll see that Neera Tanden actually viewed inviting Benjamin Netanyahu as something that helped her recruit a board member who was very pro-Israel. And of course, board members, their whole job is basically to give money and raise money. So that is another kind of look into how some of these folks operate, just like politicians or like governments. Sometimes think tanks view, you know, raising money as part of keeping, you know, the lights on. And I think sometimes they're willing to compromise other values in order to do that.
Right. In fact, in the leaked documents, we see that she emailed John Podesta that she knew that there was pushback about hosting Netanyahu. But then once she got this donor on board, right, she said it was worth it. The BB thing was worth it. Smiley face. Mm-hmm. Meaning it worked to bring someone in. Jonathan Levine, I believe is his name. He's a donor. Mm-hmm. Big pro-Israel guy, quote unquote pro-Israel. And why do you think there is such a – why is this so important? Like, why is Center for American Progress so threatened by someone like Bernie Sanders? What's this all about? Zed, you want to respond, and then Ben, and then we'll
– Yeah, I mean, I think it is important to make a distinction. I think there's probably a number of people at CAP today who are going to vote for Bernie Sanders who did last time, particularly some of the younger, more idealistic people, so on and so forth. But I think – you know, one thing you have to realize about CAP, and the same thing holds true for Heritage Foundation on the right-wing side of the aisle, is that sometimes these think tanks, they kind of serve as launching pads for people to work in government. And so I think a lot of these folks were really ready to work for Hillary Clinton in 2016, and they thought Bernie Sanders had no chance. And I think that's why a lot of the leadership was so harsh against Sanders. And I think that's kind of their worry now, that if Sanders takes power, he is going to pursue single-payer healthcare, which they are opposed to. He's going to pursue a very different foreign policy than they are supporting. And so it's almost kind of like, they're kind of protecting their career turf as well as their ideological turf. And, you know, that's a very, very powerful thing in Washington when you have people who worked there for 20 or 30 years, like Neera Tanden, who worked as a junior staffer for Bill Clinton, worked for Hillary Clinton, worked for Obama, so on and so forth. You know, that is a very, very powerful incentive to how they operate. And I think that that does actually explain quite a bit of what's happening here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's right. And, you know, I also think that there's a lot of, you know, sort of hangover from 2016 going on here too, right? Like, if someone not named Bernie Sanders was running for president and essentially like is and essentially has the same message and offering the same policy proposals, I don't think that there would have been much animosity toward from CAP towards this, you know, fictional, you know, presidential candidate. But there definitely is a little bit of a hangover here. I mean, I think that Hillary land still feels a little bit aggrieved because, you know, they saw Sanders as, you know, roughing up Hillary before the general election and all that sort of stuff. So I think there's a little bit of that. And I think there's a little bit of, you know, sort of personal stuff going on that's, you know, been simmering for, you know, more than a decade. But also at the same time, like you said, like this this piece that Think Progress did was awful. It was just terrible. And what better way for the Bernie Sanders campaign to highlight the point that it's been making,
yeah,
that you know, corporate interests and establishment interests are trying to work against him. Like, what better way to do that than to call them out on this and then start raising money? I mean, I think it was a really good move on their part.
Yeah, it was a good move, right? And of course, they're being blamed for opening up old wounds as if the attack video, I mean, it's kind of victim blaming. Like, they went after Sanders and then he responded. He's someone who really doesn't. He stays above the fray, as we all remember. Although some people, I guess, don't remember, or I'm not sure what it is. I think people have some kind of derangement when it comes to Bernie, but one should remember that he famously said enough about the goddamn emails. So he's a pretty, you know, issues oriented guy, but this, as you said, it's a good way to, this is a part of the issues, right? Because one of his issues is not letting the corporate wing of the Democratic Party be ascendant.
Yeah, and I think that for Bernie and for Bernie's camp, I think it was really more about that than you know, this sort of Neera-verse,
oh yeah,
you know, Faz, or, you know, I think it was more about that. And I think also, you know, this probably isn't really going to happen again. You know, you've already seen, you know, we already mentioned how Neera, you know, said that you know, the piece in question was overly harsh. You've seen staffers from Bernie and Neera on Twitter sort of like, you know, easing tensions and saying thank you for your response and all right. This kind of stuff. So yeah, I think going forward, you know, it's going to be much more amicable. And this was just more, I think, maybe just for Bernie to pump up his message a little bit.
Nice. Well, great job. And guys, thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find you online? Zed, where can they find you? Then Ben.
Yeah. Well, I have one, you can read my work at Greater Good Science Center at Berkeley, where I write about polarization. Also, I have a podcast called Extremely Offline, where we kind of do cross-partisan, cross-tribal discussions, which you can see it on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher. So that would be great too.
Great. And Ben?
And I would encourage your listeners to go to winwithoutwar.org. We are an organization that promotes progressive foreign policies and a vision. And I'm on Twitter at Benjamin JA.
Great. And thank you so much for joining us. It's a really great transition to go from this part of the discussion in particular to our next segment, because I'm going to be speaking to Rebecca Vilkormerson from Jewish Voice for Peace and a student organizer from NYU named Sarah. So this dovetails really nicely from the BB discussion. Really excited to have two guests live in the studio. Rebecca Vilkormerson is the director of Jewish Voice for Peace, and Sarah is a student organizer at NYU. And it's really cool because I actually saw both of you Monday night at an event at NYU where, Rebecca, you spoke.
Rebecca Vilkormerson is the executive director of Jewish Voice for Peace, which is a leading national organization inspired by Jewish tradition to work for a just peace for all the people of Israel and Palestine. She's been a member of JVP since 2001 and executive director since 2009. She's widely published by numerous media outlets, including the LA Times, CNN, The Nation, The Hill, Huffington Post, In 2010, she was named one of the 50 most influential Jewish American leaders by the Forward, and was named one of the 50 most American Jewish leaders worldwide by the Jerusalem Post in 2017.
Two students from NYU spoke. Mark Lamontel spoke, and then Omar Barghouti spoke via Skype because he is the guy who founded BDS, Boycott, Divest, Sanction, and the United States won't let him come in to the country, even though he had a visa and was going to come.
This U.S. entry ban against me, which is ideologically and politically motivated, is part of Israel's escalating repression against Palestinian, Israeli, and international human rights defenders in the BDS movement for freedom, justice, and equality. Israel is not merely continuing its decades-old system of military occupation, apartheid, and ethnic cleansing, it is increasingly outsourcing its outrageous McCarthyite repression to the US and to xenophobic far-right cohorts across the world. Supporters of Israeli apartheid in the US are desperately trying to deny US lawmakers, media, diverse audiences at NYU, Harvard, Uncle Bobby's bookstore in Philadelphia, and at Tzedek Chicago Synagogue their right to listen firsthand to a Palestinian human rights advocate calling for ending U.S. complicity in Israel's crimes against our people. But all my speaking engagements will proceed as planned, albeit via screen. One thing that this ban deprives me of, and that I cannot compensate, is the right to be at my U.S.-based daughter's wedding. I am hurt, but I'm not deterred. With the evolving intersectional links connecting BDS for Palestinian rights with the struggles of communities of color, indigenous Americans, women activists, Jewish millennials, trade unionists, academics, artists, LGBTQ groups, students, anti-war movements, and others, we shall prevail. We shall intensify our common fight against fascism and racism in all its forms through our morally consistent struggle for justice, for dignity, and for a life that is worth living, as our late poet Mahmoud Darwish once said. Thank you.
And you can't go to Israel, Rebecca.
Right.
So it's kind of a frustrating, political Romeo and Juliet story, if you will. But that was a great talk, and I wanted to thank you guys for doing that. Also, just talk about what organizing you guys are doing, what the status of your BDS organizing is. And also, though, something interesting is that Sarah, who's in the studio right now, I wanted to start with you, if that's okay. You didn't want your last name to be used.
Yes.
And can you explain to listeners why that is?
Yes. So I've been a part of the Palestinian human rights activism for a while now, especially at NYU. And something that has repeatedly happened is I have been verbally attacked by people that are sort of opposed to my political stance in this situation. And I also have friends who have been subject to, constant harassment, like online and in person. And I think just for my own physical health as well as, or physical safety as well as mental health, I really would not like to open
right.
sort of the floodgates to further harassment at this moment.
And can you talk about that website, Canary
Mission?
Yeah.
Yes. There's a website called Canary Mission that, it says its mission is to sort of out anti-Semitic professors and activists and students. It really focuses on college campuses, but goes larger than that too. And really what it does is it profiles students that are part of activist organizations such as Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voices for Peace, and sort of gives a lot of information about them. Oftentimes pulls up old photos of them
right.
that aren't particularly flattering, and it's something that if somebody is going into a job interview, and their prospective employer Googles them. The first thing that'll come up is often this profile that's calling them an anti-Semite,
right.
when oftentimes it's just that they are a Palestinian human rights activist.
Right.
a lot of these students are Jewish themselves. I myself am Jewish, and I think I've been lucky enough to avoid having my picture on this this website, but it is something that I'm very cautious of because of that.
Right. And we get the, we have the honor as Jews of being called like self-loathing. I mean, they will call us anti-Semitic, but it's, we have somewhat of a buffer, I think. And Rebecca, you actually yesterday, one of the things you talked about was using our privilege as like Ashkenazi Jews. So can you talk about what you guys are working on now, and I guess how people listening can be, whether they're Jewish or not Jewish, different roles that people can play in this movement?
Yeah, so in terms of the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement, specifically BDS, as we call it, I think one of the great things about it as a tool is that for organizing is that it's both an educational opportunity, and then once people get educated and motivated and activated, there's opportunities for action, and that those like opportunities for action are always very localized and very specific to the communities that people are in. So one of the first BDS campaigns that JVP was involved in was trying to get the pension fund TIA-CREF to divest, among other companies, from Caterpillar. And so in talking to people about Caterpillar, we were able to talk about home demolitions, we were able to talk about Rachel Corrie's death, we were able to talk about land expropriation. You know, so there's an opportunity to explain the reason why we're choosing a target, which helps people understand the conditions that Palestinians are facing, and then say, okay, now you have something to do about it, because this, your pension company, in this example, is invested in Caterpillar, and you have the power as a person who has shares in this pension fund to make noise about that. So similarly, like the NYU students just had an incredible victory where they got, they organized their student council to pass a divestment bill. So the way BDS works is allows people to do that organizing, which really raises a lot of awareness, brings more people in, and then also creates these opportunities for action. And the other great part about it, of course, is that it's global.
Right.
So there's this sort of boomerang effect of wins. One of the things that Omar Barghouti talked about last night was the sort of global win against Veolia. And that was really, it was about Veolia's investment in the light rail connecting Jerusalem to the settlements. But it was based on campaigns that were happening mostly all over Europe, because Veolia is a European country. There were some campaigns here too, but the wins in each country helped to make that ultimate win.
Right.
So it's really about supporting each other globally and being aware of what each other are doing globally and how to build these campaigns and to the point of winning them. I could talk a little bit about JVP's BDS campaigns. We do a lot of support work, so like NYU JVP chapter.
And that's Jewish Voice for Peace for people just tuning in.
Yes, thank you. The NYU JVP is part of, was part of a big coalition that Sarah can talk about, of groups, a really incredible coalition, very multiracial, multi-ethnic, multi-religious, interfaith, really impressive organizing of like how, and it shows how broad the support for BDS campaigns, I think, are growing in all, in particular on college campuses, but really everywhere. But we do a lot of support work when we have our member chapters and stuff like that who are involved in specific campaigns locally. The, we did have a big win in the fall, which was after about 2 or 3 years of organizing that we did within a big coalition. It wasn't at all just us, to get Airbnb to withdraw from the settlements. Unfortunately, last week they reversed that decision. And it's actually a pretty interesting story and kind of pretty typical for how we do two steps forward, one step back. What happened was they got sued. And basically they got bullied into reversing their decision. And I think that this is not the end of the story. The Center for Constitutional Rights is going to is already in the process of suing back. But
you know, so who sued them? What were the...
I don't remember who it was exactly, but there's a whole panoply of, you know, what we call lawfare organizations that are using these sort of suits in a very, very, I have to say, smart way.
Right, of course.
Is there a corporation like Airbnb, and do you want to face the, you know, face a long drawn out lawsuit to enforce a policy that was kind of being forced on you anyway? You know, just it changes the the balance of things that they're factoring in. So I think lawfare, we're going to see a lot more of that. We're seeing all kinds of sort of nuisance lawsuits against humanitarian organizations that offer aid in Gaza, for example. And so I think it's really, it's a very strong tactic. And I think about it on a continuum with Canary Mission, you know, because they're all silencing and bullying and intimidation tactics.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not about having a substantive argument. It's about shutting down the conversation. So that's also in the same way that there's all these anti-BDS bills being passed in states around the country, also part of the silencing and bullying and intimidation. And we could, I think we can look at it in some ways showing like we're winning the argument.
Right.
Very much so. And we're seeing that in every poll we see, is that people's minds are being changed quite rapidly in terms of supporting Palestinian rights. But the response of the opposition is really to play dirty.
Right. Yeah. And smear, like, you know, to smear anything critical of Israel as anti-Semitic, which of course is an anti-Semitic trope, right? Because they're conflating Jewish identity with an unquestioning support of the Israeli government,
that's right.
Which is something that so many generations of Jews have pushed back against, right? And Sarah, can you talk about your political, personal evolution on this issue?
Sure. So I really first got involved with Palestinian human rights efforts really when I got to college. I was raised in a Jewish household, and Israel-Palestine really wasn't something we talked about.
Had you been to Israel?
I hadn't. Okay. I know birthright was something that came up
right.
often. My parents would mention it to me. I was lucky in the sense that I think my parents did make some effort to show that this was like a two sort of side issue.
Right.
They didn't just sort of frame it as like, well, there's Israel
right.
and, you know, you're going to go there one day. I think when I got to college, I started talking to people from JPP. And honestly, I really did talk to people from both sides. I think a pushback I've heard from my family often is like,
right.
oh, well, you got to listen to both sides. And I did. But I think what I realized is, you know, a lot of my Jewish education was tied into social justice.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like a huge value, human rights. That was like a very important part of my Jewish upbringing. And I think the more I was beginning to learn about these human rights abuses against Palestinians, I just felt like that was something that I had to become involved in. I had to start advocating for Palestinian human rights. Otherwise, it was almost like insulting to my Jewish values that
right.
I was brought up with.
Yeah. And what was your Jewish education? Was it a Hebrew school thing? Was it a secular thing? What was the...
I went to Hebrew school. I did my bat mitzvah, the whole thing.
Right.
My family was sort of more that we weren't that religious. It was
right.
more we practiced all the holidays.
Yeah.
My grandparents are very conservative, so we often would, you know, attend services with them.
Conservative Jews, like
yes.
religious wise, not
religious,
politically. Yeah.
Yeah, religious wise. Yeah, I think it was definitely always had a presence in my life. And I think, like, culturally, my family is very Jewish, religion aside, too.
Right.
Which definitely impacted a lot of the way I view the world.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
Like the principle of Tikkun Olam?
Yes.
Or, which
Tikkun
is
Olam was very, very important to my brain. I think there was literally, like, I had a year in Hebrew school where that was, like, the main theme
right.
of what we were learning about. And that definitely struck me.
Which is Hebrew for repair the world.
Yes.
And it's a social justice principle, right?
Yes.
And what about you, Rebecca? How did you get to where you are on this issue?
Well, it's a longer story. I have way more years
Sorry,
to talk
yeah.
about. But I grew up in the conservative stream of Judaism, also in the synagogue that my grandparents founded. My father's sister actually, you make Aliyah
right.
when you move to Israel, which the translation from the Hebrew is going up, so
yeah.
that sort of tells you it has an ideological component
right.
to it. So my aunt made Aliyah and moved to a religious national kibbutz right after college, and then my grandparents followed her there.
And your family was raised. I mean, you were raised in...
I was raised in the U.S.,
yeah.
New Jersey
okay, nice.
Specifically. So my father's entire family was in Israel by the time I was born, and my parents actually went to Israel for about a year and a half, I think, to figure out if they wanted to do the same thing, and ultimately they decided they didn't, and so I was born in the U.S., but always very connected to Israel because of my grandparents and my aunt and uncle, and eventually my cousins being there, and so we were going back and forth my whole childhood. You know, I didn't question much as a child. I also, you know, went to Hebrew school. I always say it was like Holocaust Israel,
right.
the kind of like Hebrew school education that
right.
we got, which I think it's so impoverished, honestly.
Yeah.
Like, I belong to a Reconstructionist synagogue in Brooklyn now, and both my daughters, my younger daughter was just bat mitzvah a couple
oh,
weeks
mazel
ago.
Tov.
Thank you. You know, and the education they're going to get is so much more spiritual
right.
and is so much more rich, and they're learning about the histories of Jewish communities all over the world.
Right,
and
yeah.
so, I regret that the focus on Israel and on Jewish history, and of course, this is an earlier time. The Holocaust was less far away than it is
right.
now. But that, even that being said, like, I wish they'd done more. You know, I regret that form of Hebrew school education
right.
that was so focused on that.
And you could take the Holocaust. I mean, people have done this, right? You point to the Holocaust not as kind of a justification for what Israel does, which some people do, right?
Right.
But you can also, if you're going to do never again, right, there are people, there are even Holocaust survivors who have been like, this is why, because we went through this, this is precisely why we have to, you know, respect the humanity
absolutely.
Of Palestinians.
Absolutely. No, I'm definitely not saying people shouldn't learn.
Yeah. Oh, no, no. I know you weren't saying that. I was just thinking
and
that that's
think
another way of,
yeah. Within the Jewish community, right. Which has been there for a long time, which is like, never again for us.
Exactly.
Never again for everyone.
Right.
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 I think like that very much informs the way JVP works.
Right. Exactly.
What we're saying is the lesson we need to learn is never again for everyone. And
right.
That's what leads to our focus on solidarity,
yeah.
Safety for all people, universal values of justice for all people and all that sort of thing. And I do think, you know, it does flow from there.
Right. Yeah. It's funny. Just last week we were talking about Stephen Miller, whose uncle has spoken out.
Yeah.
Stephen Miller, who worked for Trump, who initiated a lot of these firings. And they fired the Kristen Nielsen, who was the head of the Homeland Security, for being too soft, basically. I mean, she's a woman who separated children from their families. And Stephen Miller's uncle has gone on television, and he's like, I'm a private guy. I think he's a neuroscientist or something. He's like, but I have to say that, you know, if my family had been treated the way that Stephen Miller wants people to be treated now, I wouldn't exist because my family would have gone up the chimneys, you know, in the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have been born. My sister wouldn't have been born. Stephen, his nephew wouldn't have been born. And we were talking about how you can identify with that or you can not identify with it. And you can say never again just for this group of people, in which case there's no solidarity.
That's right.
Or you can see it as part of a larger, you know. And of course, the irony is that, or not the irony, but during the Holocaust, it was Jews. It was, you know, I mean, now we would say LGBTQ people. Communists, you know, there are a variety of people who were targeted.
Roma, yeah.
Yeah, the Roma, right.
Yeah.
People with disabilities. So it was a ironically intersectional, you know, genocide. I cut you off though. We were talking about this.
Yeah, so
never again.
Anyway, so I skip forward a few years. I became politicized in various ways and I began to identify on the left. This was the 90s. I was working on things like fighting Clinton's welfare reform plan.
Right.
That dates me. But I think this is very typical of this generation and of my generation, of every Jewish generation. I felt like it was too hard to deal with, you know, to deal with this issue. I didn't think I knew enough to have an argument with my father about
right.
it. I was scared
yeah.
to challenge my
yeah.
community,
I used,
my
yeah,
rabbi,
yeah.
to like step out from like what the sort of cozy community was.
Right.
And so I avoided it, even though I had this like strong left analysis. And for me, it was the Second Intifada that changed that. And, you know, I was living in San Francisco at the time and you know, I remember a very specific incident, which some people remember, where there was actually a picture on the front page of the New York Times, which I don't know that we would see that right now, of a young boy whose name is Mohammed Dora, who was 4 years old, being held in his father's arms while they were under fire. And, you know, the caption was that he'd been killed a moment later. And I was just horrified. And I wrote to a friend of mine who is Palestinian. And I, you know, and I said to him, like, I can't believe this. This is not, you know, this is not Jewish values.
Right,
this
yeah.
is not us. And like, to his eternal credit, he didn't write back to me and say, like, what is wrong with you? How have you not known about this?
Right,
he
yeah.
wrote back to me and was like, I'm so glad you're thinking about this now.
Yeah.
You know, by the way, if you're interested in this, I could tell you more about it.
Right.
You know, and I've really taken that as a model ever since. Because again, people jump in all different places
right.
of what they know. And so you have to be ready to meet people where they are and believe they have the capacity to change. He was obviously being very generous.
Right.
And I give him a lot of credit for that. But, you know, that's a very important piece of it, is that you need to sort of, like, people have their moments. And certainly, like, the Second Intifada was a moment for people my age. For some people, it was the First Intifada. For some people, it was Sabra and Shatila, which was in the 80s. For some people, it was the Gaza War in 2014.
Right.
So there's people coming in all the time, and you have to be ready to take the time to bring them along.
Yeah, and not shame them. Be like, where were you?
Yeah.
It's not good organizing.
Right,
honestly.
It's not
yeah.
good organizing. But once I think what helped is that because I already had a sort of left framework,
right.
once I had the nerve to face it,
yeah.
then I could fit it straight in. Like, it was very clear to me that, like, I don't believe unequal citizenship
right.
based on ethnicity or race or religion.
Right.
So how could I justify that? You know,
yeah.
until then I was able to fit it in pretty easily.
Right.
And so that shifted a lot for me.
It's funny, last night you said, on Monday night at the event at NYU, you said that the right wing is ascendant, but the left wing is ascendant too. And Mark Lamont Hill, who was fired from CNN, and they wanted to fire him at Temple University where he works, he said that there's an asterisk that says, except for Palestine, you know, on contract negotiations or free speech issues, you know. And you said that it's getting harder and harder for people who identify as progressive to carve out Palestine. That's like this exception, mm-hmm. right? And there is this thing called PEP, Progressive Except on Palestine, mm-hmm. and that's getting less and less kind of defensible and less of the norm. I mean, it's I can't believe how much things have changed, like, absolutely. Over a year. I mean, I think Ilhan Omar has a lot. I mean, a lot of things. She's both a symptom and I think part of the reason why things are changing. I think that the attacks on her were so... It's so interesting. Like, I really didn't think people would weather it the way... I didn't think she would weather it. I mean, watching her go after Elliot Abrams, yeah. like, mm-hmm. right after she was smeared as an anti-Semite was amazing.
Yeah.
And by the way, if you want to be an ally against anti-Semitism, please don't tell anyone that Elliot Abrams is Jewish. That's how you can do your part. You don't want to be associated with him. We have to go. It was so fast. But any last words, Sarah and then Rebecca, on what you want people to know about, what you're working on? Anything you want our listeners to know?
I think.
What are you guys working on? Anything like that? Yeah.
So at NYU, we just passed this resolution on human rights, the Palestinian human rights. I mean, I think we're still trying to work to get that to be passed by the university. The student government passed it, to right. clarify. You know, one of the things that was sort of disheartening is right after we passed it in the student government, the university almost like immediately released a statement saying, we're not even going to look at this, which again goes back to the idea of, you know, I don't know if I'd call NYU progressive, but I'm like progressive except for on Palestine. And yeah, I think we're not going to give up the fight. We're going to keep working on that resolution. I know there have been talks from members of our student government, with university representatives about how to approach this matter and how to approach this resolution.
Yeah.
So I think that's what we're hoping for in the future.
Right. On our side, I forgot to mention our biggest campaign, which is called Deadly Exchange, which is about ending U.S.-Israeli police exchanges, which is a very, very exciting campaign. We've had a number of really exciting wins, and we're going to be gearing up again this spring and summer. But you can learn all about it at our website, which is jewishvoiceforpeace.org. If anyone wants to become a member, the dues are $18 a year.
Nice.
And you can sign up for our daily news update. You can sign up for a regular, you know, for our email list.
Great video. You guys have a great video, like a one-on-one intro to Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Oh, yes.
It's great. Yes. So check out the website. Yeah. Don't forget to check out my follow-up interview with Zijilani, where he talks about being kind of low-key censored by the Center for American Progress. And you can do that at patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.